Putting Down Roots, A Summer Day on the Banks of the Mohawk River. Anska, Degeni, Asa, Bend and Pull, Bend and Pull, Gaili, Whisk, Yayak, Rada, she calls to her granddaughter, standing waist-deep in the grass. Her bundle grows thicker with every stoop of her back. She straightens up, rubs the small of her back, and tilts her head up to the blue summer sky, her black braid swinging in the arch of her back. Bank swallows twitter over the river. The breeze off the water sets the grasses waving and carries the fragrance of sweetgrass that rises from her footsteps. A spring morning, 400 years later. Anska, Degeni, Asa. 1, 2, 3, bend and dig, bend and dig. My bundle grows smaller with every stoop of my back. I drive my trowel into the soft ground and rock it back and forth. It scrapes against a buried stone, and I dig my fingers in to unearth it, cast the stone aside to make an apple-sized hole big enough for the roots. From the tangled bundle wrapped in burlap, my fingers separate out a single clump of sweetgrass. I set it in the hole, scoop soil around it, speak words of welcome, and tamp it down. I straighten up and rub the small of my aching back. The sunshine pours down around us, warming the grass and releasing its scent. Red stake flags flutter in the breeze, marking the outlines of our plots. Gaili, Whisk, Yaya, Jada. From time beyond memory, Mohawk people inhabited this river valley that now bears their name. Back then, the river was full of fish, and its spring floods brought silt to fertilize their cornfields. Sweetgrass, called Wensarago Ohonte in Mohawk, flourished on the banks. That language has not been heard here for centuries. Replaced by waves of immigrants, the Mohawk people were pushed from this generous valley in upstate New York to the very margins of the country. The once dominant culture of the great Haudenosaunee or Iroquois Confederacy was reduced to a patchwork of small reservations. The language that first gave voice to ideas like democracy, women's equality, and the great law of peace became an endangered species. Mohawk language and culture didn't disappear on their own. Forced assimilation, the government policy to deal with the so-called Indian problem, shipped Mohawk children off to the barracks at Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where the school's avowed mission was kill the Indian to save the man. Braids were cut off and native languages forbidden. Girls were trained to cook and clean and wear white gloves on Sunday. The scent of sweetgrass was replaced by the soap smells of the barracks laundry. Boys learned sports and skills useful to a settled village life, carpentry, farming, and how to handle money in their pockets. The government's goal of breaking the link between land, language, and native people was nearly a success. But the Mohawk call themselves the Ganyagaha, people of the flint, and flint does not melt easily into the great American melting pot. Over the top of the waving grasses, I can see two other heads bent to the soil. The shiny black curls tied back with a red bandana belong to Daniela. She pushes herself up from her knees, and I watch her tally the number of plants in her plot. 47, 48, 49. Without looking up, she makes notes on her clipboard, slings her bundle over her shoulder, and moves on. Daniela is a graduate student, and for months we have been planning for this day. This work has become her thesis project, and she's anxious about getting it right. On graduate school forms, it says that I'm her professor, but I've been telling her all along that it is the plant who will be her greatest teacher. On the other side of the field, Teresa looks up, swinging her braid over her shoulder. She's rolled the sleeves of her T-shirt, which reads Iroquois Nationals Lacrosse, and her forearms are streaked with dirt. Teresa is a Mohawk basket maker and is an integral part of our research team. She's taken the day off from work to kneel in the dirt with us, and she grins from ear to ear. Sensing our flagging energy, she starts a counting chant to lift our spirits. Gaeli, Whisk, Yayak, Jada, she calls out, and together we count out the rows of plants in rows of seven for seven generations. We are putting roots in the ground, welcoming the sweet grass back home. Despite Carlisle, despite exile, despite a siege 400 years long, there is something, some heart of living stone that will not surrender. I don't know just what sustained the people, but I believe it was carried in words. Pockets of the language survived among those who stay rooted in place. Among those remaining, the Thanksgiving address was spoken to greet the day. Let us put our minds together as one and send greetings and thanks to our Mother Earth, who sustains our lives with her many gifts. Grateful reciprocity with the world, as solid as a stone, sustained them when all else was stripped away. In the 1700s, the Mohawks had to flee their homelands in the Mohawk Valley and settled at Akwesasne, straddling the border with Canada. Teresa comes from a long line of Akwesasne basket makers. The marvel of a basket is in its transformation, its journey from wholeness as a living plant to fragmented strands and back to wholeness again as a basket. A basket knows the dual powers of destruction and creation that shape the world. Strands once separated are rewoven into a new whole. The journey of a basket is also the journey of a people. With their roots in riverside wetlands, both black ash and sweetgrass are neighbors on the land. They are reunited as neighbors in the Mohawk baskets. Braids of sweetgrass are woven among the splints of ash. Teresa remembers many childhood hours spent making braids from individual leaves of sweetgrass, twining them tight and even to reveal their glossy shine. Also woven into baskets are the laughter and the stories of the gathered women, where English and Mohawk blend together in the same sentence. Sweetgrass coils around the basket rim and threads the lids, so that even an empty basket contains the smell of the land, weaving the link between people and place, language and identity. Basket making also brings economic security. A woman who knows how to weave will not go hungry. Making sweetgrass baskets has become almost synonymous with being Mohawk. Traditional Mohawks speak the words of thanksgiving to the land, but these days the lands along the St. Lawrence River have little to be grateful for. When parts of the reserve were flooded by power dams, heavy industry moved in to take advantage of the cheap electricity and easy shipping routes. Alcoa, General Motors, and Domtar don't view the world through the prism of the Thanksgiving address. And Akwesasne became one of the most contaminated communities in the country. The families of fishermen can no longer eat what they catch. Mother's milk at Akwesasne carries a heavy burden of PCBs and dioxin. Industrial pollution made following traditional lifeways unsafe, threatening the bond between people and the land. Industrial toxins were poised to finish what was started at Carlisle. Sago Gwenyongwas, also known as Tom Porter, is a member of the Bear Clan. The bear is known for protecting the people and as the keeper of medicine knowledge. Just so, 20 years ago, Tom and a handful of others set out with healing in mind. As a boy, he had heard his grandmother repeat the old prophecy that someday a small band of Mohawks would return to inhabit their old home along the Mohawk River. In 1993, that someday arrived, when Tom and friends left Akwesasne for ancestral lands in the Mohawk Valley. Their vision was to create a new community on old lands, far from PCBs and power dams. They settled on 400 acres of woods and farms at Ganajohalege. It's a place name from the time when this valley was dense with longhouses. In researching the land's history, they found that Ganajohalege was the site of an ancient Bear Clan village. Today, the old memories are weaving among new stories. A barn and houses nestle at the foot of a bluff in a bend in the river. Silty floodplain loams run right down to the banks. The hills, once laid waste by lumbermen, have regrown with straight stands of pine and oak. A powerful artesian well pours from a cliff in the bluff with a strength that endures even the deepest drought and fills a clear, mossy pool. In the still water, you can see your own face. The land speaks the language of renewal. When Tom and others arrived, the buildings were in a sad state of disrepair. Over the years, scores of volunteers have banded together to repair roofs, replace windows. The big kitchen once again smells of corn soup and strawberry drink on feast days. An arbor for dancing was built among the old apple trees, making a place where people can gather to relearn and celebrate Haudenosaunee culture. The goal was Carlisle in reverse. Ganajohalege would return to the people what was taken from them, their language, their culture, their spirituality, their identity. The children of the lost generation could come home. After rebuilding, the next step was to teach the language. Tom's anti-Carlisle motto being, "Heal the Indian, save the language." Kids at Carlisle and other mission schools all over the country had their knuckles wrapped, and much worse, for speaking their native language. Boarding school survivors did not teach their children the language of their birth in order to spare them hardship. And so the language dwindled right along with the land. Only a few fluent speakers remained, most over the age of 70. The language was teetering on extinction, like an endangered species with no habitat to rear its young. When a language dies, so much more than words are lost. Language is the dwelling place of ideas that do not exist anywhere else. It is a prism through which to see the world. Tom says that even words as basic as numbers are imbued with layers of meaning. The numbers we use to count plants in the sweetgrass meadow also recall the creation story. Unska, one. This word invokes the fall of Sky Woman from the world above. All alone, Unska, she fell toward the earth. But she was not alone, for in her womb a second life was growing. Digini, there were two. Sky Woman gave birth to a daughter who bore twin sons, and so then there were three, Asen. Every time the Haudenosaunee count to three in their own language, they reaffirm their bond to creation. Plants are also integral to reweaving the connection between land and people. A place becomes a home when it sustains you, when it feeds you in body as well as spirit. To recreate a home, the plants must also return. When I heard of the homecoming at Ganajohalege, visions of sweetgrass rose in my mind. I began looking for a way to bring them back to their old home. One morning in March, I stopped by Tom's place to talk about planting sweetgrass in the spring. I was full of plans for an experimental restoration, but I'd forgotten myself. No work could be done before guests were fed, and we sat down to a big breakfast of pancakes and thick maple syrup. Tom stood at the stove in a red flannel shirt, a powerfully built man, his pitch hair streaked with gray, but his face is scarcely wrinkled, despite his more than 70 years. Words flow from him as water flows from the spring at the foot of the bluff. Stories, dreams, and jokes that warm the kitchen like the scent of maple syrup. He refilled my plate with a smile and a story. Ancient teachings braided into his conversation as naturally as comments on the weather. Strands of spirit and matter are woven together like black ash and sweetgrass. "What's a Potawatomi doing way out here?" he asks. "Aren't you a long way from home?" I need only one word. Carlisle. We lingered over coffee, and our talk turned to his dreams for Ganjohelege. On this land, he sees a working farm where people learn again how to grow traditional foods, a place for the traditional ceremonies to honor the cycle of the seasons, where the words that come before all else are spoken. He spoke for a long time about the Thanksgiving address as the core of Mohawk relationship to land. I remembered a question that had long been on my mind. At the end of the words that come before all else, when thanks have been given to all the beings of the land, I asked, "Has the land ever been known to say thank you in reply?" Tom was quiet for a second, piled more pancakes on my plate, and set the syrup jug in front of me. "That's as good an answer as I know." From a drawer in the table, Tom took out a bag of fringed buckskin and laid a piece of soft deerskin on the table. He poured onto it a rattling pile of smooth peach seeds, one side painted black, the other white. He drew us into the gambling game, guessing how many pits in each throw will be white and how many black. His pile of winnings mounded up while ours dwindled. While we shook the pits and threw them down, he told me about the time this game was played for very high stakes. The twin grandsons of Sky Woman had long struggled over the making and unmaking of the world. Now their struggle came down to this one game. If all the pits came up black, then all the life that had been created would be destroyed. If all the pits were white, then the beautiful earth would remain. They played and played without resolution, and finally they came to the final roll. If all came up black, it would be done. The twin who made sweetness in the world sent his thoughts out to all the living beings he had made and asked them to help to stand on the side of life. Tom told us how in the final roll, as the peach stones hung for a moment in the air, all the members of creation joined their voices together and gave a mighty shout for life and turned the last pit white. The choice is always there. Tom's daughter came to join the game. She held a red velvet bag in her hands and poured its contents onto the deerskin. Diamonds. The sharp facets threw rainbows of color. She beamed at us as we oohed and awed. Tom explained that these are Herkimer diamonds, beautiful quartz crystals as clear as water and harder than flint. Buried in the earth, they are washed along by the river and turn up from time to time, a blessing from the land. We put on our jackets and walked out over the fields. Tom paused at the paddock to offer apples to the big Belgians. All was quiet, the river slipping along the banks. With the right eyes, you can almost unsee Route 5, the railroad tracks, and I-90 across the river. You can almost see fields of Iroquois white corn and riverside meadows where women are picking sweetgrass. Bend and pull, bend and pull. But the fields where we walk are neither sweetgrass nor corn. When Sky Woman first scattered the plants, sweetgrass flourished along this river, but today it's gone. Just as the Mohawk language was replaced by English and Italian and Polish, the sweetgrass was crowded out by immigrants. Losing a plant can threaten a culture in much the same way as losing a language. Without sweetgrass, The grandmothers don't bring the granddaughters to the meadows in July. Then what becomes of their stories? Without sweetgrass, what happens to the baskets, to the ceremony that uses these baskets? The history of the plants is inextricably tied up with the history of the people, with the forces of destruction and creation. At graduation ceremonies at Carlisle, the young men were required to take an oath. I am no longer an Indian man. I will lay down the bow and arrow forever and put my hand to the plow. Plows and cows brought tremendous changes to the vegetation. Just as Mohawk identity is tied to the plants the people use, so it was for the European immigrants who sought to make a home here. They brought along their familiar plants, and the associated weeds followed the plow to supplant the natives. Plants mirror changes in culture and ownership of land. Today, this field is choked by a vigorous sward of foreign plants that the first sweetgrass pickers would not even recognize. Quackgrass, timothy, clover, daisies. A wave of invasive purple loosestrife threatens from along the slough. To restore sweetgrass here, we'll need to loosen the hold of the colonists, opening a way for the return of the natives. Tom asked me, what would it take to bring sweetgrass back, to create a meadow where basket makers can once again find materials? Scientists have not devoted much effort to the study of sweetgrass, but basket makers know that it can be found in a wide array of conditions, from wetlands to dry railroad tracks. It thrives in full sun and especially favors moist, open soil. Tom bent and picked up a handful of the floodplain soil and let it sift through his fingers. Except for the dense turf of exotic species, this seems like a good place for sweetgrass. Tom glanced at the old farmall tractor in the lane, covered with a blue tarp. Where can we get some seeds? It's a strange thing about sweetgrass seed. The plant sends up flowering stalks in early June, but the seeds it makes are rarely viable. If you sow 100 seeds, you might get one plant if you're lucky. Sweetgrass has its own way of multiplying. Every shiny green shoot that pokes up above ground also produces a long, slender white rhizome winding its way through the soil. All along its length are buds, which will sprout up and emerge into the sunshine. Sweetgrass can send its rhizomes many feet out from the parent. In this way, the plant could travel freely all along the riversides. This was a good plan when the land was whole. But those tender white rhizomes cannot make their way across a highway or a parking lot. When a patch of sweetgrass was lost to the plow, it could not be replenished by seed from outside. Daniela has visited many places where historical records show sweetgrass once lived, more than half of which no longer carry its fragrance. The major cause of decline seems to be development. Native populations eliminated by wetland draining, converting wild places to agriculture and to pavement. As non-native species come in, they may also crowd out the sweetgrass, plants repeating the history of their people. In nursery beds back at the university, I've been growing up a stalk of sweetgrass, waiting for this day. I had searched far and wide for a grower who could sell us plants to begin the nursery, and finally located an operation in California that had some. This seemed odd, since Hieracloe odorata does not occur naturally in California. When I asked about where their planting stock came from, I got a surprising answer. Aquazosne. It was a sign. I bought it all. Under irrigation and fertilizer, the beds have grown thick. But cultivation is miles removed from restoration. The science of restoration ecology depends upon myriad other factors: soil, insects, pathogens, herbivores, competition. Plants are seemingly equipped with their own sense about where they will live defying the predictions of science, for there is yet another dimension to Sweetgrass's requirements. The most vigorous stands are the ones that are tended by basket makers. Reciprocity is a key to success. When the sweetgrass is cared for and treated with respect, it will flourish. But if the relationship fails, so does the plant. What we contemplate here is more than ecological restoration. It is the restoration of relationship between plants and people. Scientists have made a dent in understanding how to put ecosystems back together, but our experiments focus on soil pH and hydrology, matter to the exclusion of spirit. We might look to the Thanksgiving address for guidance on weaving the two. We are dreaming of a time when the land might give thanks for the people. We walked back up to the house, imagining basket classes in years to come. Maybe Teresa would be the teacher, leading her granddaughter into the field that she herself has helped to plant. Gana Johalege runs a gift shop to raise funds for the work of the community. The shop is filled with books and beautiful artwork, beaded moccasins, antler carvings, and of course baskets. Tom unlocked the door and we stepped inside. The still air smelled of sweetgrass hanging from the rafters. What words can capture that smell? The fragrance of your mother's newly washed hair as she holds you close. The melancholy smell of summer slipping into fall. The smell of memory that makes you close your eyes for a moment, and then a moment longer. When I was young, I had no one to tell me that, like the Mohawks, Potawatomi people revere sweetgrass as one of the four sacred plants. No one to say that it was the first plant to grow on Mother Earth, and so we braid it as if it were our mother's hair to show our loving care for her. The runners of the story could not find their way through a fragmented cultural landscape to me. The story was stolen at Carlisle. Tom walks over to the bookshelf and chooses a thick red volume to lay on the counter. The Indian Industrial School, Carlisle, Pennsylvania, 1879 to 1918. In the back of the book is a list of names, pages and pages of them. Charlotte Bigtree, Mohawk. Stephen Silverheels, Oneida. Thomas Medicine Horse, Sioux. Tom points to show me his uncle's name. "That's why we're doing this," he says. "Undoing Carlisle." My grandfather is in this book, too, I know. I run my finger down the long columns of names and stop at Asa Wall, Potawatomi. A pecan-picking Oklahoma boy, just 9 years old, sent on the train across the prairies to Carlisle. His brother's name comes next, Uncle Oliver, who ran away back home. But Asa did not. He was one of the lost generation, one who never could go home again. He tried, but after Carlisle, he didn't fit anywhere. So he joined the army. Instead of returning to a life among his family in Indian Territory, he settled in upstate New York, not far from this riverbank, and raised his children in the immigrant world. At a time when cars were novel, he became a superb mechanic. He was always fixing broken cars, always mending, seeking to make things whole. I think that same need, the need to make things whole, propels my work in ecological restoration. I imagine his knife-nose profile leaning over the hood of a car, his brown hands wiped on a greasy rag. During the Depression, people flocked to his garage. Payment, if there was any, was often in eggs or turnips from the garden. But there were some things he couldn't make whole. He didn't talk much about those days, but I wonder if he thought of the pecan grove in Shawnee, where his family lived without him, the lost boy. The aunties would send boxes for us grandchildren. Moccasins, a pipe, a buckskin doll. They were boxed away in the attic until our Nana would lovingly take them out to show us, to whisper, "Remember who you are." I suppose he achieved what he had been taught to want, a better life for his children and grandchildren, the American life he was taught to honor. My mind thanks him for his sacrifice, but my heart grieves for the one who could have told me stories of Sweetgrass. All my life I have felt that loss. What was stolen at Carlisle has been a knot of sorrow I've carried like a stone buried in my heart. I'm not alone. That grief lives on in all the families of those whose names appear on the pages of that big red book. The broken link between land and people, between the past and the present, aches like a badly broken bone, still unknit. The city of Carlisle, Pennsylvania, is proud of its history and wears its age well. To celebrate its tricentennial, people looked hard and honestly at the scope of its history. The city began as the Carlisle Barracks, a mustering ground for soldiers of the Revolutionary War. Back when Federal Indian Affairs was still a branch of the War Department, the same buildings became the Carlisle Indian School, the fire beneath the great melting pot. Today, the Spartan Barracks that once held rows of iron cots for Lakota, Nez Perce, Potawatomi, and Mohawk children are genteel officers' quarters with blooming dogwoods at the doorstep. In honor of the anniversary, the descendants of all those lost children were invited back to Carlisle for what were called ceremonies of remembrance and reconciliation. Three generations of my family traveled together to be there. With hundreds of other children and grandchildren, we converged on Carlisle. This was the first time most laid eyes on a place only hinted of in family stories, or not spoken of at all. The town was decked out in star-spangled bunting draped from every window. A banner on the main street announced the upcoming tricentennial parade. It was lovely, a postcard-perfect town of narrow brick streets and buildings of rosy brick restored to colonial charm. Wrought iron fences and brass plaques with dates celebrate its antiquity. How surreal it seems that Carlisle has earned a reputation in America for fervent preservation of its heritage, while in Indian country, the name is a chilling emblem of a heritage killer. I walked silently among the barracks. Forgiveness was hard to find. We gathered at the cemetery, a small fenced rectangle beside the parade ground, with four rows of stones. Not all of the kids who came to Carlisle left. There lay the dust that was born a child in Oklahoma, in Arizona, at Akwesasne. Drums sounded in the rain-washed air. The scent of burning sage and sweetgrass wrapped the small crowd in prayer. Sweetgrass is a healing medicine, a smudge that invokes kindness and compassion, coming as it does from our first mother. The sacred words of healing rose up around us. Stolen children, lost bonds. The burden of loss hangs in the air and mingles with the scent of the sweetgrass, reminding us that there was a time when all the peach stones threatened to turn black side up. One could choose to assuage the grief of that loss by anger and the forces of self-destruction. But all things come in twos, white peach stones and black, destruction and creation. If the people give a mighty shout for life, the peach stone game can have a different ending. For grief can also be comforted by creation, by rebuilding the homeland that was taken. The fragments, like ash splints, can be rewoven into a new whole. And so we are here along the river, kneeling in the earth with the smell of sweetgrass on our hands. Here on my knees in the dirt, I find my own ceremony of reconciliation. Bend and dig, bend and dig. By now my hands are earth-colored as I settle the last of the plants, whisper words of welcome, and tamp them down. I look over at Teresa. She is intent, finishing up her last bundle of transplants. Daniela is making her final notes. The light is growing golden at the end of the day over our newly planted field of spindly sweetgrass. If I look at it just right, I can almost see the women walking a few years ahead. Bend and pull, their bundles growing thicker. Feeling blessed for this day by the river, I murmur to myself the words of thanksgiving. The many paths from Carlisle, Tom's, Teresa's, and mine, converge here. In putting roots in the ground, we can join the mighty shout that turned the peach pit from black to white. I can take the buried stone from my heart and plant it here, restoring land, restoring culture, restoring myself. My trowel digs deep into the soil and strikes against a rock. I scrape away the earth and pry it up to make room for the roots. I almost cast it aside, but it's strangely light in my hand. I pause for a closer look. It's nearly the size of an egg. With muddy thumb, I rub away the dirt, and a glassy surface is revealed, then another, and another. Even beneath the dirt, it gleams as clear as water. One face is rough and cloudy, abraded by time and history, but the rest is brilliant. There is light shining through. It is a prism, and the fading light refracts, throwing rainbows from within the buried stone. I dip it in the river to wash it clean and call Daniela and Teresa to come see. We are all struck with wonder as I cradle it in my hand. I wonder if it's right to keep it, but I'm torn by thoughts of laying it back in its home. Having found it, I find I cannot let it go. We pack up our tools and head up to the house to say our goodbyes for the day. I open my hand to show the stone to Tom to ask the question. This is the way the world works, he says, in reciprocity. We gave sweetgrass, and the land gave a diamond. A smile lights his face, and he closes my fingers over the stone. This is for you, he says. Umbilicaria, the belly button of the world. Glacial erratics stud the Adirondack landscape. Granite boulders dropped in place when the glaciers got tired of rolling them and melted their way back home to the north. The granite in these parts is an orthosite, among the oldest rocks on Earth and resistant to weathering. Most of the boulders have been rounded by their journey, but some still stand tall and sharp-edged, like this one, which is as big as a dump truck. I run my fingers over its surface. Veined with quartz, the top is a knife edge, and its sides too steep to climb. This elder has sat silently in these lakeshore woods for 10,000 years, as forests have come and gone, lake levels ebbed and flowed. And after all that time, it is still a microcosm of the post-glacial era when the world was a cold desert of rubble and scraped earth, alternately baking in the summer sun and snow-blasted in the long winter. Without soil, in a world still treeless, the glacial till provided a forbidding home for pioneers. Undaunted, Lycans volunteered to put down roots and homestead stone. Metaphorically, of course, since they have no roots. This is an asset when there is no soil. Lichens have no roots, no leaves, no flowers. They are life at its most basic. From a dusting of propagules that lodged in tiny pits and fissures just a pinprick deep, they settled the bare granite. This microtopography gave protection from the wind and offered concavities where water might rest after a rain in a microscopic puddle. It wasn't much, but it was enough. In the span of centuries, the rock became glazed with a gray-green crust of lichen, almost indistinguishable from the rock itself, a bare coating of life. The steep faces and exposure to the winds off the lake have prevented any accumulation of soil, its surface a last relic of the Ice Age. I come here sometimes just to be in the presence of such ancient beings. The sides of the boulder are festooned with Umbilicaria americana in raggedy ruffles of brown and green, the most magnificent of northeastern lichens. Unlike those of its tiny crustose forebears, the Umbilicaria's thallus, its body, can span an outstretched hand. The largest one recorded was measured at just over 2 feet. Tiny ones cluster like baby chicks around a mother hen. So charismatic a being has accumulated many names. It is most frequently known as the rock tripe and sometimes as the oak leaf lichen. Rain cannot linger on the vertical faces, so most of the time this boulder is dry, and the lichens shrink and get crisp, making the rock look scabby. Without leaves or stem, Umbilicaria is simply a thallus, roughly circular in shape, like a tattered scrap of brown suede. Its upper surface, when dry, is a mousy shade of taupe. The thallus edges curl up in a chaotic sort of ruffle, exposing the black underside, which is crisp and grainy like a charred potato chip. It is anchored tightly to the rock at its center by a short stalk, like a very short-handled umbrella. The stalk, or umbilicus, cements the thallus to the rock from underneath. The forest the lichens inhabit is a richly textured plantscape, but they are not plants. They blur the definition of what it means to be an individual, as a lichen is not one being, but two, a fungus and an alga. These partners are as different as could be, and yet are joined in a symbiosis so close that their union becomes a wholly new organism. I once heard a Navajo herbalist explain how she understands certain kinds of plants to be married due to their enduring partnership and unquestioning reliance on one another. Lichens are a couple, in which the whole is more than the sum of its parts. My parents will celebrate their 60th wedding anniversary this year and seem to have just that kind of symbiosis, a marriage in which the balance of giving and taking is dynamic, the roles of giver and receiver shifting from moment to moment. They are committed to an us that emerges from the shared strengths and weaknesses of the partners, an us that extends beyond the boundaries of coupledom and into their family and community. Some lichens are like that too. Their shared lives benefit the whole ecosystem. All lichens, from the tiny crusts to the stately Umbilicaria, are a mutualistic symbiosis, a partnership in which both members benefit from their association. In many Native American wedding traditions, the bride and the groom present each other with baskets of gifts, traditionally representing what each promises to bring to the marriage. Often the woman's basket contains plants from the garden or meadows to show her agreement to provide food for her husband. The man's basket may contain meat or animal hides, a promise to provide for the family by hunting. Plant food and animal food, autotroph and heterotroph, The alga and the fungus also bring their particular gifts to their union as a lichen. The algal partner is a collection of single cells, gleaming like emeralds and bearing the gift of photosynthesis, the precious alchemy of turning light and air to sugar. The alga is an autotroph, or one that makes its own food, and will be the cook of the family, the producer. The alga can make all the sugar it needs for energy, but it's not very good at finding the minerals it needs. It can only photosynthesize when it's moist, but it has no ability to protect itself from drying. The fungus partner is the heterotroph, or other feeder, since it can't make its own food, but must subsist on the carbon harvested by others. The fungus is brilliant at the art of dissolving things and liberating their minerals for its use, but it can't make sugar. The fungal wedding basket would be filled with specialized compounds like acids and enzymes that digest complex materials into their simpler components. The body of the fungus, a network of delicate threads, goes out hunting for minerals and then absorbs those molecules through its huge surface area. Symbiosis enables the alga and the fungus to engage in a reciprocal exchange of sugar and minerals. The resulting organism behaves as if it were a single entity with a single name. In a traditional human marriage, the partners may change their name. When an alga and a fungus get together, we name it as if it were one new being, an interspecies family, as it were, rock tripe, Umbilicaria americana. In Umbilicaria, the algal partner is almost always a genus that would be called Tribugia if it lived alone or was not lichenized. The fungal partner is always a type of ascomycete, but not always the same species. Depending on how you look at it, the fungi are quite loyal. They always choose Tribugia as their algal partner. The alga, however, is a bit more promiscuous, willing to hook up with a wider array of fungi. I guess we've all seen marriages like that, too. In their shared architecture, the algal cells are embedded like green beads in a fabric woven of fungal hyphae. If you sliced a cross-section of the thallus, it would be like a cake with four layers. The upper surface, the cortex, feels like the top of a mushroom, smooth and leathery. It's tightly woven of fungal filaments or hyphae to hold in moisture. The dusky brown coloration acts like a natural sunscreen that shields the alga layer, which lies just below, from intense sunlight. Below the shelter of the fungal roof, the algae form a distinct medulla layer where the hyphae wrap themselves around the algal cells, like an arm draped over a shoulder or a loving embrace. Some fungal threads actually penetrate the green cells, as if they were long, slender fingers reaching into a piggy bank. These fungal pickpockets help themselves to the sugars made by the alga and distribute them throughout the lichen. It has been estimated that the fungi take as much as half of the sugars the alga produces, maybe more. I've seen marriages like that too, one partner siphoning off way more than he or she gives. Rather than thinking of lichens as a happy marriage, some researchers view them more as reciprocal parasitism. Lichens have been described as fungi who discovered agriculture by capturing photosynthetic beings within fences of hyphae. Below the medulla, the next layer is a loose tangle of fungal hyphae designed to hold water and thus keep the algae productive for longer. The bottommost layer is coal black and prickly with rhizines, microscopic hair-like extensions that help attach the lichen to the rock. The fungal-algal symbiosis so blurs the distinction between individual and community that it has attracted a great deal of research attention. Some pairs are so specialized that they cannot live apart from one another. Nearly 20,000 species of fungus are known to occur only as obligate members of a lichen symbiosis. Others have the capacity to live freely, yet choose to join an alga to become a lichen. Scientists are interested in how the marriage of alga and fungus occurs, and so they've tried to identify the factors that induce two species to live as one. But when researchers put the two together in the laboratory and provide them with ideal conditions for both alga and fungus, they gave each other the cold shoulder and proceeded to live separate lives in the same culture dish, like the most platonic of roommates. The scientists were puzzled and began to tinker with the habitat, altering one factor and then another, but still no lichen. It was only when they severely curtailed the resources, when they created harsh and stressful conditions, that the two would turn toward each other and begin to cooperate. Only with severe need did the hyphae curl around the alga. Only when the alga was stressed did it welcome the advances. When times are easy and there's plenty to go around, individual species can go it alone. But when conditions are harsh and life is tenuous, it takes a team sworn to reciprocity to keep life going forward. In a world of scarcity, interconnection and mutual aid become critical for survival. So say the lichens. Lichens are opportunistic, making efficient use of resources when they're available, and otherwise happily doing without. Most of the time when you encounter Umbilicaria, it is as crisp and dry as a dead leaf, but it's far from deceased. It's only waiting, empowered with a remarkable physiology to endure drought. Like the mosses with whom it shares the rocks, lichens are poikilohydric. They can photosynthesize and grow only when they are wet, but they're not able to regulate their own water balance. Their moisture content mirrors the moisture in the environment. If the rock is dry, so are they. A rain shower changes everything. The very first drops splatter hard against the rigid surface of rock tripe, which instantly changes color. The mud-brown thallus becomes sprinkled with clay-gray polka dots, the tracks of raindrops, which deepen over the next minute to sage green, like a magic picture developing before your eyes. And then, as the green spreads, the thallus begins to move, as if animated by muscle, stretching and flexing as the water expands its tissue. In a matter of minutes, it is transformed from a dry scab to tender green skin, as smooth as the inside of your arm. With the lichen restored, you can see how it got its other name. Where the umbilicus anchors the thallus to the rock, the soft skin is dimpled, with little wrinkles radiating about its center. It looks to all the world like a belly button. Some are such perfect little navels that you want to kiss them like a little baby tummy. Some are kind of saggy and wrinkled, like the old woman whose belly carried those babies. Since the navel lichen grows on vertical surfaces, the top will dry out faster than the bottom, where moisture collects. When the thallus starts to dry and its edges curl up, a shallow water-holding trough forms along its lower edge. As the lichen gets older, it becomes asymmetrical, the bottom half as much as 30% longer than the upper, a legacy of lingering moisture that permitted it to keep photosynthesizing and growing after the top half was dry and still. The trough can also collect debris, the lichen equivalent of belly button lint. I lean in close and find lots of baby thalli, little brown discs about the size of a pencil eraser, scattered over the rock. This is a healthy population. These juveniles arose either from broken fragments of the parent or, because of their perfect symmetry, more likely from specialized propagules called ceridia, a little package of both fungus and alga designed for joint dispersal, so they'll never be without their partners. Even the tiny thalli are dimpled with navels. How fitting that this ancient being, one of the first forms of life on the planet, should be connected to the earth by an umbilicus. The marriage of alga and fungus, umbilicaria, is the child of earth, life nourished by stone. And people are nourished by umbilicaria, as the name rock tripe suggests. Rock tripe is generally categorized as a starvation food, but it's not so bad. My students and I make a pot every summer. Each thallus may take decades to grow, so our harvest is minimal, just enough to taste. First, we soak the thallus overnight in fresh water to remove the grit it has accumulated. The soaking water is poured off to leach away the powerful acid the lichen uses to eat away at the rock. Then we set it to boil for half an hour. It yields a lichen broth that is quite palatable and rich enough in protein to gel like consommé when it is chilled, tasting vaguely of rock and mushroom. The thallus itself we cut into strips that are like a chewy pasta, making a quite serviceable lichen noodle soup. Umbilicaria is often the victim of its own success. Accumulation is its undoing. Slowly, slowly, the lichens build up a thin layer of debris around them, perhaps their own exfoliations, or dust, or falling needles, the flotsam of the forest. The dusting of organic matter holds the moisture that the bare rock could not hold, and gradually an accretion of soil creates a habitat for mosses and ferns. Through the laws of ecological succession, the lichens have done their work of laying the foundation for others, and now the others have come. I know a whole escarpment covered with rock tripe. Water trickles down fissures in the cliff face, and the trees have closed in, making a shady paradise for mosses. The lichens colonized in an earlier day, before the forest was thick and moist. Today they look like an encampment of floppy canvas tents on the rock, some now tattered with sagging roof lines. When I scan the oldest tripe with my hand lens, I see they're crusted over with algae and other crustose lichens, like microscopic barnacles. Some have slippery green streaks where blue-green algae have made themselves at home. These epiphytes can impede the photosynthesis of the lichen by blocking out the sun. A deep pillow of hypnum moss catches my eye, vivid against the dull lichens. I move along the ledge to admire its plush contours. Sticking out from its base, like a ruffle around a pillow, are the edges of an umbilicaria thallus, nearly engulfed by the moss. Its time has come to an end. The lichen, in a single body, unites the two great pathways of life. The so-called grazing food chain, based on the building up of beings, and the detrital food chain, based on taking them apart. Producers and decomposers, the light and the darkness, the givers and receivers, wrapped in each other's arms, the warp and the weft of the same blanket so closely woven that it's impossible to discern the giving from the taking. Some of Earth's oldest beings, lichens are born from reciprocity. Our elders share the teachings that these rocks, the glacial erratics, are the oldest of grandfathers, the carriers of prophecy, and our teachers. Sometimes I go to sit among them, the proverbial navel gazer at the belly button of the world. These ancients carry teachings in the ways that they live. They remind us of the enduring power that arises from mutualism, from the sharing of the gifts carried by each species. Balanced reciprocity has enabled them to flourish under the most stressful of conditions. Their success is measured not by consumption and growth, but by graceful longevity and simplicity, by persistence while the world changed around them. It is changing now. While lichens can sustain humans, humans have not returned the favor of caring for lichens. Umbilicaria, like many lichens, is highly sensitive to air pollution. When you find umbilicaria, you know you're breathing the purest air. Atmospheric contaminants like sulfur dioxide and ozone will kill it outright. Pay attention when it departs. Indeed, whole species and entire ecosystems are vanishing before our eyes in the vanguard of accelerating climate chaos. At the same time, other habitats are on the rise. Melting glaciers are exposing land where it has not been seen for millennia. At the edge of the ice, newly scraped land is emerging, a jumble of rocky till, harsh and cold. Umbilicaria is known to be among the first to colonize post-glacial forelands today, just as it did when the earth was raw and bare 10,000 years ago, another era of great climate change. Our indigenous herbalists say to pay attention when plants come to you. They're bringing you something you need to learn. For millennia, these lichens have held the responsibility of building up life. And in an eye blink of Earth's history, we have set about undermining their work to usher in a time of great environmental stress, a barrenness of our own making. I suspect that lichens will endure. We could too, if we listen to their teachings. If not, I imagine umbilicaria will cover the rocky ruins of our time long after our delusions of separateness have relegated us to the fossil record, a ruffled green skin adorning the crumbling halls of power. Rock tripe, oak leaf lichen, navel lichen. I'm told that umbilicaria is known in Asia by another name, the ear of the stone. In this almost silent place, I imagine them listening to the wind, to a hermit thrush, to thunder, to our wildly growing hunger. Ear of stone, will you hear our anguish when we understand what we have done? The harsh post-glacial world in which you began may well become our own unless we listen to the wisdom carried in the mutualistic marriage of your bodies. Redemption lives in knowing that you might also hear our hymns of joy when we too marry ourselves to the earth.